This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we turn on the neon in Seoul and drop in on an expo dedicated to signage.
Public design is about the appearance of a city. Things like outdoor signs, transportation screens in bus shelters or on benches. We're trying to match up designers that use LED lights or other digital forms of signage with those in the public sector.
We stay in the world of the word, but this time the written one. We're in New York meeting one of the calligraphy industry's leading pensmiths.
I discovered the tools that they would have written those letters with originally. A bottle of ink, a metal nib, a pen holder. And I picked them up and when I started writing with them, it was very, very natural.
And then we visit a landmark example of the high-tech architectural movement of 1970s Britain, located in the paradoxically leafy London suburb of Hampstead.
It's never been a style that many people have built their houses in, but there have been quite a few examples in America and also in England. And we thought, actually, it'd be really interesting. We needed a cheap, quick house.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Signs tell us a lot of things, like where to go, what's for sale and what's on the menu. In South Korea, sign makers are keeping up with the latest technological advances in offline digital advertising. The work of these designers was recently on show at a sign design expo. Our man in Seoul, Jason Strother, dropped in to take a look.
If you love the smell of ink, then this is the place to be. There are hundreds of industrial-sized printers all around me. They're spitting out vibrantly colored advertising posters from all sorts of companies. I spot a vodka advert and a Van Gogh reprint, just to name a couple. There are also flashing LED panels everywhere that burnt holes into my retinas. And there's a gang of men in matching blue outfits shaping pieces of metal into 3D letters. 200 South Korean companies are taking part in the 21st annual Korea Sign, or COSIGN Expo. They range from small design shops and manufacturers to big-name firms like Korea Telecom. It's a one-of-a-kind event, says Kim Tae-young of COEX, the convention center that puts on COSIGN. He says it's a great venue for Korean sign makers to show how they're keeping up with the changing industry.
Traditionally, sign makers would use machines to make signs, or other forms of advertising. But now companies are much more focused on digital signage. I think this year, the event is trying to put more emphasis on public designs.
What are public designs?
Public design is about the appearance of a city. Things like outdoor signs, transportation screens in bus shelters or on benches. We're trying to match up designers that use LED lights or other digital forms of signage with those in the public sector.
Kim also explains that the digital revolution of sign design has significant environmental benefits.
Sign advertisements are considered a type of visual pollution. It really doesn't help a city's appearance. Too many signs can confuse people, and, of course, there are environmental problems when disposing of old signs. Digital signs can limit these concerns, and when you use them with LED lighting, it enhances their efficiency. That's why the government is promoting the use of digital signage.
Kim says that in Seoul, there are laws that prevent the use of conventional painted signboards, so digital and LED are really the future of advertising here. Back on the convention hall floor, I walked over to the guys hammering and bending metal into both English and Korean letters. They work for the company 1AM, and manager Teddy Yoon tells me about the types of signs they're making.
People are using the channel letters instead of the printing.
Yoon explains that sign makers buy the shapes his company makes, then they attach LED lights to them for advertising.
To make the shape into metal, take a long time, you need a lot of manpower, right? Cost is high.
Making these complicated shapes by hand would take a lot of time, but 1AM has built a machine that does it quick.
Yeah, can you show me how it all works?
Yoon brings me over to a computer and starts punching in some coordinates.
Transfer the computer, push the button, this way is moving, and then bending the shape.
The outline.
It starts bending and cutting the metal that will eventually be turned into an LED line character.
Almost got hit by a piece of metal right there.
Now I'm standing in front of an enormous printer whose head is swinging back and forth like a huge pendulum. It's a prototype made by the Korean firm Digital Illustrate Incorporated. I stick my mic in front of company representative Park Dae-bok.
This is the biggest printer I've ever seen in my life, so I just wanted to ask you, how big are the signs that it makes?
5 meters.
5 meters long. So these signs that you make with this printer, what's the material that it prints onto?
Yes, we have experienced to test already. So Starflex film, some kind of film, and then the sticker paper, yeah, something like that.
Cool, and how much do one of these cost?
Oh, sorry, sir. As I told you, this machine is prototype. And over this year, yes, we will be the final custom.
In the back of the convention center, there's a sort of hall of fame for award-winning signs. It seems that whoever picks these winners enjoys seafood, as most of the signs are from fish restaurants. There's a 2-meter-long blueback fish for a restaurant of the same name. Here's a sign for an eel restaurant with glowing white letters set in front of rice paper that is made to resemble the way you cook this eel over an open fire. And behind me is another sign for a fish restaurant called Dreaming Fish. You can actually reach out and touch the scales of this glowing white fish. I'm no ichthyologist, but it looks like a carp to me. But in a country where almost everyone has a smart device, are signs still the best way to reach consumers? I put that question to manager Kim Tae-young.
I feel the most effective way to advertise is still signs. Even though people are into their iPhones or tablets and still search for things using that technology, signs still work. Businesses still prefer to use physical signs to advertise their products.
So whether they're light-up fish, 3D letters, or blinding LEDs, signs aren't coming down anytime soon. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Coming up, upcycled architecture and converted cargo containers. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're with Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. From their offices in Naples and New York, the low-tech architectural studio has been winning awards since it first opened in 1993, thanks to their upcycled buildings made using cargo containers. Monocle's very own Santiago Tarditi sat with Ada Toller, one of the partners, to discuss their latest projects.
We're very interested in the things that we have around, and we're not interested just in the act of reusing. We're actually interested in the creative appropriation of things. And so there is really an idea of recognizing the intelligence of many of these objects that we have around us, and sort of challenging also that intelligence, both being opportunistic, but also being very transformative, being very radical in the way we use these objects. So on one end, there is a real enamorment with these things. You know, we really like them, we really love them, and we have studied them and understood them deeply and discovered their intelligence, their own system, the way they work, their own structural integrities, and so on and so forth. And so then there is the desire to take them from this kind of lower life that is more utilitarian, that many of these objects, and I'm thinking about, you know, from trucks, there's many going in front of us right now, tanks, mixers, containers of all sorts. You know, the idea of taking them from a more utilitarian life into something that is definitely of a higher level, you know, from high-end homes to an art center or an art studio or a cultural space and so on and so forth. So the idea of really bringing them up into a higher place of our existence, but at the same time allowing them to express themselves for what they are. So we never really hide these objects. We transform them very radically, but we also want these objects to be what they are.
Well, to illustrate the idea, I'm going to ask you to maybe go over some of the projects you've developed in the past years. We have a portfolio just in front of us with what mostly looks like containers, but it's a bit more than that.
There's more than that, yes. Maybe we'll start from more recent. So the Whitney Studio is a smaller project that we did for the Whitney that is actually up at the Whitney right now and will stay up until the museum moves. And that was born out of the need of the museum to create educational space, basically an art classroom for the museum education department, and in the transition that the Whitney is having between the Madison building, the Breuer building where they're at right now, and the new building that Enzo Piano is building downtown, they basically don't have any more additional spaces as they used to have because they sold a lot of them. And so they came to us with this idea of like occupying the moat. Of course, for us, it was incredibly compelling also because we really love the Breuer building. It's one of our absolute favorite in New York. And so the idea of being able to work right against that was very interesting. And the program of an art studio seemed really right. So the project turned out to be this really minimal kind of cube. It's a black cube that was dropped in pieces. Of course, inside the moat and fits it very tight. We thought about it almost as a piston, you know, that goes up and down this little space. And it's incredibly minimal from the outside in its kind of monolithic blackness. And then on the inside is very spacious and completely white, and it's got this big double height, and sort of like the design for us is always often, if not always, driven by a set of operations that we apply to objects. So on one end, there is the idea of upcycling these existing objects, for instance, in this case, 6 shipping containers. But on the other end, there is also the idea of what we do to these objects. We cut them, we crop them, we stack them, we do a whole series of things. And in this case, the thought was very much to drive a diagonal plane through these objects, through the stack. So we made the cube and then we drove a diagonal plane through it. And that diagonal plane cut everything. It cut the skin, it cut the ceiling and floor of the in-between level to create a double height. And it created this skylight at the top, windows along the sides. And many of these things are driven both by our intention from a design standpoint, but also by program. Like the Whitney, for instance, had asked us that they wanted windows that allow people to have a sense of what was happening inside this studio, but not for it to feel like a fishbowl. So the idea of like this very big and long diagonal window was very appealing because you could sort of peep through at all the levels, but you weren't really completely seeing anything.
And that's not the only project you have going on or have concluded here in New York. You're currently working on the Super Pier.
It's a project that started in a very impromptu way. We had been working with a developer, Young Wu and Associates, for many years on different things, often retail, but different kind of projects in different parts of the world. And when the RFP came out for the Super Pier, back then Pier 57, Young came to us and he said, you know, I've been thinking that this would be an interesting project, but I don't really know what to do with it. Do you guys have any thoughts? So we came up with this idea of really transforming it into a market, an open space, a public space, a park, a sort of like complex space where a lot of different functions from cultural to commercial intermingle. We love the building. The building is a fantastic piece of industrial basic architecture from the middle of last century and was used first as a cruise ship terminal and then as a bus depot. So it has been fairly transformed, but it's also very interesting because it's very plain. It's this shed that has these really big spans and very large and long spaces, and is right on the water, which is kind of a fantastic experience, especially for us coming from Naples. We responded to that connection to the water right away. And so the project developed very much from the idea of keeping the building as much as possible for what it was, and instead inserting almost an independent architecture within the building and taking advantage of the building both in length but also in height. So every level is actually a double level because we are stacking containers on top of one another to form two levels for every level. So a main level and a secondary, let's say, mezzanine level within each space, leaving the existing space of the super pier very much for what it is. There will be a variety of commercial, cultural, food programs that will occupy the pier. We are currently under permitting at the building department. It was very interesting experience for us because we run the old, let's say, competitive process right at the same moment where Obama was running the campaign, and we called ourselves the Obama team because we were, you know, the youngest group with the youngest architect and the least known developer. We were battling against very, very powerful developers, both from New York and the States. And, you know, we were like this little unknown group that had this really strong ideas. Didn't want to turn the building into a mall. We didn't want to enclose it. We wanted to let it be much more like a galleria, like an open space, following also the idea of the meatpacking district, the porticos. It's been interesting also because we submitted the RFP right at the moment when the economy crashed. And in a way, I think the project has turned out to be much more sustainable than other projects. And it's not just because we are recycling or upcycling over 300 containers, which is a fantastic aspect of it. You know, we always say we always get to upcycle so few of these objects. But on this project, we're really, it's a very muscular kind of intervention. But also because I think overall the strategy and the idea of like a different kind of retail that relied more on the synergy of a lot of smaller places next to one another rather than the big anchor tenants turned out to be very interesting, and it's very relevant right now in the city. So, you know, they talk about it as these incubators also of potentially new businesses from design to craft to food, lots of food. You know, this is the moment of food in our culture and definitely in the city. So we're very happy that there is a real intention to start construction at the end of the year.
Ada Toller speaking to Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi there. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Rajiv Surendra's fascination with classic handwriting and calligraphy started as a child, but it wasn't until a few years ago that he started his own business as a designer. Originally, he mostly created beautiful pen and ink work. It was when he first picked up some chalk, though, that his company Letters and Ink really took off. Pauline Eiferman met him in New York, a city he has just moved to from his native Canada in order to expand his reach.
We have three candles lit. We have this beautiful 1840s elaborate inkwell with two glass ink bottles. One of them is filled with brown ink. We have a little piece of cloth that's used for blotting the ink and a wax seal from the 1800s and a red stick of wax. And then some great paper. There are many different factors that affect the finished product. The flexibility of the nib, the size of it, the metal, how old it is. This is actually an antique nib. It's an old vintage nib. There's an incision or a cut in the middle of the nib. And what that does is it allows the nib to split open when pressure is applied. So that property is what creates this beautiful writing. When I press down on the pen, when I'm making a downstroke, it makes the line wider. When I'm going up, the line is a single thin line. And that contrast of thick and thin lines is what makes this copper plate script so beautiful. I'm just going to dip the nib into the ink. That muscle memory takes years to achieve, so that when I throw or pull a stroke, so this is called throwing a stroke, when I make a stroke away from me, and this is pulling a stroke, and that those lines have to be fluid.
And so how did your interest in calligraphy start?
When I was 12 years old, an older friend had given me a pile of letters from the 1800s. So they were handwritten letters, and I think my older friend knew that I would like these, and I did. I was kind of fascinated with the letters. What drew me to them was the handwriting, the style of handwriting. All of the writing was very, very beautiful. I took those letters to elementary school, and we had to write in cursive for certain things, and I would copy some of the letter forms whenever I was intrigued to do so. So if there was a beautiful W in one of the letters, then I would copy the way they wrote that W. And slowly over the course of a few years, that style of handwriting became my handwriting. So when I was in high school and I was using a ballpoint pen, I would be writing that way. And then in university, I discovered the tools that they would have written those letters with originally. Bottle of ink, a metal nib, a pen holder. And I picked them up, and when I started writing with them, it was very, very natural. I started using the calligraphy for very specific things. So if I was sending a letter to the CEO of a company, I would address the envelope with calligraphy, and it would always get to the person that it was addressed to. It usually bypassed the assistant. So I discovered that there was a power to this.
Tell me about when this hobby of yours, this passion, became a business.
So 2 years ago, a wedding planner in Toronto, she saw my work. I was having a fun art event at a paper shop in Toronto, where I decided to collaborate with the paper shop and offer the public free calligraphy on anything that they bought in the store. And it was a big success. There was a lineup of people that had things to be written on. And in the lineup was this wedding planner, Catherine Lash. And she saw my work, and she really suggested that I start this as a business. She said that there was a market for this and that it could really take off. So I did, and she was right. It was well received by not only the clients that were employing me, but the public. I think the thing about what I'm doing is that calligraphy in the past couple of decades has really been employed by much older people. And so when I started this as a business, just the fact that I'm a lot younger, it pushed it towards a younger audience, the hipster crowds of young, artistically inclined people noticed it. So it was taking a very conventional skill, which is lettering and handwriting, but using it in a beautiful artistic way. And I think the pairing of those two things was something that just spread very, very quickly.
And it went much further than just ink on paper, right? You started using different formats.
It did. When I started my business in January, it was kind of slow. I was getting work, but a good friend of mine suggested doing something that could potentially spread the word, redoing chalkboards for restaurants and shops and cafes. Summer was soon approaching, and the weather was getting warmer in Toronto, and people were putting their A-frame chalkboards outside on the sidewalk, and they all kind of looked the same. You know, someone in the shop or the cafe just wrote up the message very quickly and put it out. I took a suggestion, and I just rode my bike all over Toronto that summer, and every chalkboard that I saw that looked like it could use my help, I went in and asked the owner if I could redo the board. By the end of the summer, the work for me had really changed from pen and ink work to chalk work. So people were now asking me to come inside to their restaurants and redo the menu on the wall. Restaurant owners were actually painting walls with chalkboard paint so that I could put up a menu in chalk, which was great. A little later on, it turned into a lot of kind of editorial work and advertising work, where I was doing chalkboards that were going to be photographed and then published in print.
And as you started really studying calligraphy, did you come across different styles? I imagine that over the years, writing has changed a lot. Do you have favorite styles that you work with?
Calligraphy as a field entails many different fonts. My inspiration to do this was to just emulate a beautiful kind of handwriting. And that is what I've kind of stuck to. So I really have one style of writing, and it's based on a font or a style called copperplate, which was at its heyday in the late 1700s, early 1800s. That type of script is called copperplate because it would actually be engraved into copper plates that were going to be reprinted. I'm going to go into my bag and pull out something. You know, we have this as a form of correspondence, or you have this. And what I've just laid down is my cell phone, which is a black box of plastic. If I want to send a message to somebody, if I wanted to congratulate someone on something, or I want to offer my condolences, or I'm in love with someone and I just want to tell them how much I care about them, these are the two options that I have in front of me. And if I pick this cell phone up and send a text message, or I could do this. And there is something so much more powerful about sitting down and doing this that is being lost when you take the other way, when you choose to send a message with that cold, impersonal thing. And I feel very, very strongly that a lot of today's sort of problems in the Western world with people trying to identify themselves and figure out what to do with their lives, those problems, I feel, stem from a lack of connection to tangible things that you can hold with your hands. Our lives today are so filled with digital correspondence and screens that flash images in front of you and sending a message right away and not hearing back and then wondering why you didn't hear back. And what is that? It's a world that actually doesn't even really exist. We think it does, but it doesn't. I feel like if you pull yourself out of that and sit down with a piece of paper and a pen and write to somebody, you will start to understand a little bit more about yourself.
Calligrapher Rajiv Surendra speaking to Pauline Eifman in New York there. It's sometimes been said that the British never really got the hang of modern architecture. And certainly the UK's modernist expression was dwarfed by activities on the European continent and in the Americas. In the 1970s, however, a new generation of British architects came to the fore. The movement was loosely known as high tech, and it was to become one of the most recognised faces of global corporate and industrial architecture. Exposed service functions and structures with colourful, playful approaches to modernity defines high tech. Sir Michael and Lady Patty Hopkins of Hopkins Architects were pioneers of the style and recently hosted the launch of an exhibition on the era to be held at the Royal Institute of British Architecture early in 2014. The Hopkins home in Hampstead, North London is the ultimate example of the high-tech style. Monocle's David Pleasant took the chance to have a look around the house with Lady Patty, the architect, owner and occupier.
We're standing on the street-level floor, but it's actually first floor in relation to the garden. We have another level, garden level. So we have this rather useful house you can enter at both floors. This entrance level is our sort of living level. It's where we have our working points, our study points, and it's also where we can sit and chat to friends. But also we have our bedroom bay. We don't really have rooms in this house. We have bays divided by Venetian blinds. And we have our bedroom up here because we rather like living on the same floor.
So we're actually at kind of at the threshold of the bedroom and the kind of open plan sitting room office area. And if we just talk a little bit about the history of this house and really what it represents. We're here on the launch of a series of exhibitions by the RIBA, really tackling the subject of the Brits who built the modern world, is the name of the exhibition. And this house is kind of a really early, small example of a whole kind of genre and theme of architecture that followed. To some people, it's known as high-tech architecture. And perhaps can you describe some of those elements that make it high tech? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of structure?
Well, this is a steel framed house. It's a two-story steel framed house. We chose to build a small scale steel structure with a base size of 2 meters by 4 meters. They're supported by columns which are just 2.5 inches square. And the floor and the roof have a beam system, a lattice beam system, and these are all left exposed so that the aesthetic of the inside of the house is a steel frame.
And there's those zigzags and they kind of complement the lovely Venetian blinds. So there is that high-tech feeling and the furniture that over the years you've chosen, some much older than the period of the house, some newer, you know, there's a kind of definite exposure.
The zigzags are actually bracing frames. They're very essential to the frame so that they don't let it help it not to parallelogram. So you get two on each facade and the house has got is glazed street side and the garden side. It's a detached house just from its neighbours, and the side walls are made of a profile metal with a very good plastic finish. They're silver and the frame is blue, so you get this rather interesting sort of quasi-metallic look.
Those colours and forms perhaps you might associate with the 1980s, and that kind of style is perhaps being re-evaluated and you know, reappreciated.
This was built in 1975, and it's never been a style that many people have built their houses in, but there have been quite a few examples in America and also in England. It was an aesthetic that we enjoyed. We'd built, particularly Michael in his previous practice, had built bigger scale steel structures, mostly factories or office buildings, and we thought actually it'd be really interesting. We needed a cheap, quick house. We'd sold our own house to buy the site, our old house to buy the site. And we also thought we're in a very rather beautiful, leafy Georgian street in Hampstead. We also thought that this rather light aesthetic would, although very different, would go rather well in work rather well in the street.
We're very lucky this morning. It's a late autumn morning, so the light's kind of coming almost horizontally through the Venetian blinds, and there's that kind of dappled light on the carpet. And finally, just in terms of you having lived here, have there been any kind of problems, or has it been have technical kind of issues arisen and you've kind of had to deal with them as an architect? What are the main kind of pitfalls of this style of architecture? Let's talk.
Well, the first thing that happened was we moved in here with very young children. As they grew up, they said, we don't want just these Venetian blinds, we want walls. So that was the first change we made. So we built them some bedrooms down below. The building regulations back in the 70s were not nearly as onerous as they are now. And since fairly recently, I've re-insulated the side walls by taking the cladding off and putting in a much more efficient, the same width, same thickness, because the whole of the building is quite small scale, but a much better insulant, and I've done the same thing on the roof. And I've also replaced the glazing, which was only single glaze, so I've double glazed it. And now we comply with today's standard, and it's a much easier house a much better house to live in, really.
And if I may just say, it's very well maintained. All the finish seems to be kind of almost like it was put up yesterday.
Well, these are original finishes, actually. The only maintenance we actually have to, apart from dusting the blinds and the side walls, we've repainted the blue probably about 3 times. And re-carpeted, you know, and everything else is sort of the original finishes, which is, you know, rather a plus, actually.
Lady Patty Hopkins talking to David Pleasant there. Please do stick around, because coming up we have our weekly regional roundup. We're setting our sights on Canada.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, in our attempts to offer up a global selection of stories, it's perhaps inevitable that some will fall by the wayside. That's why on Section D each week, we're going to take a moment to look over some of the big developments across the design and architecture industries in a country or region with a special guest as our guide, a journalist, expert or practitioner, or occasionally all three. This week, Section D producer Aled John caught up with Luigi Ferreira, architect and director of the Centre for Arts and Design at George Brown College in Toronto. On the agenda, population booms, town planning and university initiatives.
Post-industrial information era, people are wanting to move to more dense, urbanly vital districts and quarters. And so you're seeing a flight from the suburbs into the core. In Toronto, that's manifested itself in, you know, over 120 towers under construction, you know, more urban growth happening than in the core than in the inner suburbs and in the peripheries, more construction cranes than New York, LA, Atlanta, and Chicago combined. It's just a confluence of factors. And one of the factors is that Toronto was always a city that hadn't experienced the tremendous suburban flight that the American cities experienced and had a more vital core. So there was less a need for redevelopment. So it's really what's happening is an enhancement and a new vibrancy in the urban core.
Before we talk about the implications for the kind of quick, fast development of flats and residences that this boom is going to provoke, let's talk a moment about the complete city idea, which you cited at the beginning of the discussion. What makes a complete city? It's something that we focus on quite a lot in Monocle 24. It's an interesting idea, a city that can both cater to families, but also people who like shared accommodation. It's kind of an all-encompassing beast. What to you makes a complete city?
Well, I think it's when you create an environment that's truly holistic, where you know, your economic, your social, and your cultural needs are met, and where people are integrated versus being divided. I think one of the flaws of American planning has been the division of the city and the division of classes and the division of socioeconomic groups through a kind of planned unit development approach. I think, you know, what makes a complete city is when everyone feels comfortable and everyone's connected. I always remember when Richard Sennett described what true community is about. True community is not when people who are like-minded live together. True community is when people who are very different come together to build things that serve all of their needs versus their selfish needs, right? So in a sense, a complete city includes everyone. It includes the young, the old. It doesn't isolate the old off in a pastoral setting. It actually integrates them near hospitals and near young people so that there's intergenerational collaboration happening. So thinking holistically and thinking about all the aspects of life and making sure that all of them are within walking distance, that there's a connection between everyone, that people aren't isolated and excluded in particular areas, I think that's what makes a complete city.
So looking then at the proposed development and the kind of the answer to the question of a boom in population in downtown Toronto, we're broadcasting from the centre of London. London is a city which perhaps does provide a good example of those kind of communities that you cite, communities that are organically woven together, not by bulldozing neighbourhoods and kind of building new districts. Is Toronto going to be able to meet the demand for new housing? Because London, it isn't, despite being an example of perhaps those communities that are very well integrated.
You know, I lived in London. I worked for James Stirling there years ago. And I, you know, it is, you're so right. It's an example of a place that is very layered and where communities have developed over time and everything is close at hand and you have exchange between people. In Toronto, we have a similar thing. We're kind of unique in that we have the most multicultural city in the world, something I think London also experiences. But we're really multicultural on steroids. And somehow we still managed to integrate everyone and to have everyone kind of interacting and feeling part of a whole. What threatens Toronto is the pace of the redevelopment, and the redevelopment on former brownfields means that we're maybe building incomplete communities in the downtown core. Now, our planners, I think, are doing a strong job at trying to make sure that this doesn't happen. But when you have a very fast pace of development, it's very easy to accelerate the housing development without accelerating the development of the institutions and workplaces and community and social centers that need to be integrated into that. And what you're experiencing in London is probably something akin to what we're experiencing here, where housing costs are rising and not everyone can afford to be in the core. And there's a risk that we call it the jelly-filled donut, where you have a rich jelly in the center, and then you have a ring that is underserviced and underrepresented.
I like that analogy. So looking at some of the debacles that are taking place within Toronto City Centre, the planning division of Toronto City proper is coming up against a bit of a public backlash against their view that Frank Gehry's new building proposal in Toronto is too dense, or in fact, I think one of the phrases used was too dense or trite.
Yes, I think some of our planning staff aren't in favor of the proposal. I think they're concerned that it's eliminating some 19th century warehouses that are along that strip of land and not incorporating them. From my perspective on this particular project, the project is actually quite a beautiful project. It's three towers, very distinctive, unique. They may be slightly denser than they might want to be in the long term. But one of the things that's unique and outstanding about them, comparison, is the actual elegance of the tower design. They actually have been designed and set in a way that you actually get light and views and have really what is a pleasing perspective as you're living. Whereas a lot of the towers that have gone up that actually may be shorter, actually fill their site and don't have the proper facing distances. In Toronto, we have a bit of a problem, because what's happening in the city is that our true heritage, especially, say, buildings that were built in the 40s or 50s that are outstanding works of architecture, are actually being allowed to be torn down. And actually, we're saving buildings that are not necessarily critical to save, or that there is enough of a surplus of buildings of that order in the city. So, this is a chance, and from my perspective, a chance to have a development in the city that has outstanding grade-related components, from a museum to a research center for our Ontario College of Art and Design University, to a spectacular retail complex with really three outstanding towers. And what's getting in the way of it, I think, is a willingness of the city to deal with the small heritage issues, but not the big heritage issues. So, the city has let developers rip down the Salvation Army headquarters that we had in the city by John Parkin, one of our greatest architects, and allowed for a mall to expand, and put in a Costco kind of use. They allowed the Inn in the Park, which was created by Peter Dickinson, a famous Anglo-Canadian architect. They tore down the complex to allow car sales showrooms, right? So they're allowing valuable heritage to be torn down to build very specious new projects that don't really add to the city. And yet somehow a project that's going to result in, really a world-class museum, three amazing towers, a study center for, an art and design university, that actually is being given more resistance than really projects that should have been resisted and outright refused.
Why is that? So, what reasons are they coming together? I mean, because the allegations that it's too dense or trite or banal, perhaps, that there's a lack of, a shortfall in proposed parking, I believe, is one of their complaints. What are the main reasons for them not wanting this project to go ahead?
To me, it's really unclear. They've approved a number of projects that are in the 80-plus stories for residences on very tiny sliver sites without parking. And all of a sudden, here is a project that has tremendous public benefit and they're not approving it. And I'd hate to say this, but I have a feeling sometimes in Toronto, when you're trying to do the good thing, you actually get more resistance than when you're trying to do the wrong thing, right? So I would take it back to what I call our colonial heritage. We're very much colonial mentality. In that sense, it's provincial. So maybe people with deeper connections into the political circles, et cetera, are able to build their tall towers on very tiny sites. But when you're trying to do something that is, maybe Toronto doesn't believe that actually that they will be delivered this wonderful jewel that's been designed. I have to say that the first design that I saw for it was not as successful as the redesign. So maybe the resistance of the city is also useful in a certain sense to push the design and to guarantee that we're going to be delivered a top quality Gehry building.
Just finally on this point then, Luigi, would you say it's fair to say that Toronto perhaps needs a bit of an architectural facelift, and the kind of the green lighting of this project would represent that?
I think so. I think one of the problems that we have in Toronto is that we have outstanding planning generally. And so we are getting mixed use, mixed income neighborhoods far, far in excess of what other cities in North America are doing. But one of the things that have been lacking is a quality execution on the architecture. We have some outstanding institutional buildings that have been built, but the residential fabric of the city and the commercial tower fabric of the city, after the, you know, we had a high period where we have one of Mies van der Rohe's greatest buildings, one of Ai Pei's grandest buildings. You know, we have some of Canada's leading architects' top towers in our downtown core. But since the 90s, there's really been a poverty in the architecture, not in the urban spaces that are being built, not in the planning, but in the quality of the architecture for our commercial office and commercial residential.
That was Luigi Ferreira talking there with Alad John. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. We're staying in Toronto now. Most people don't know that the human and the bee species go back a long way. An architect and an artist in Canada are trying to correct that with their latest art installation at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. Entitled Beekeeping for All, a troop of mannequin beekeepers make the case for why we should not be too busy to pay attention to bees. Monocle's Jason Lee speaks to Jana Levitt, the architect involved.
Up until recently, like before the Second World War, if you were a farmer, you kept bees so that you had a pollinator. So you weren't afraid of bees, you understood what they did, you used the honey for cooking, you used the jelly for allergies. Like, there's so many uses for honey, and it was just part of this bigger system. And it's only since the war that we have devolved in a way to the point where honeybees are strangers.
That's Jana Levitt. She's an architect by trade and she frequently dabbles in the arts. Pretty complementary fields, but not many architect artists can flaunt a membership card to the Ontario Beekeepers Association. Well, Jana has one. So she jumped at the opportunity when Vancouver-based artist Mafonwy McLeod invited her to collaborate on a bee-related project while they were on a weekend retreat organized by a foundation called Cape Farewell, which is dedicated to using art to address pressing climate issues. The result is an art installation at the Carbon 14 exhibition at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. Beekeeping for All is a bright yellow kiosk architecturally inspired by an apiary or a bee yard. The letters P, H are emblazoned in black at the front. A team of children mannequins in full bee suits stand guard.
We started to go off on this idea that maybe what we needed to do was to create a kiosk that was really attractive and would suggest the idea, like places in Cuba, where currently they set up kiosks to send out, to give away information, seeds, because they are doing a lot with urban agriculture. So we start to work with the idea of a kiosk that's more following the lines of agitprop artwork, and a kiosk is very architectural. And then with the army, we felt like, you know, we wanted to sort of have this call to arms that there'd be an army of beekeepers. As Mafon, we said, we played with scale. So we used small people to talk about a big issue. And then we had these badges at the back that were custom made that are like the beekeeping army's logo.
And what does PH stand for?
The People's Hive.
People's Hive. It's quite interesting because it's also like smack right in the center of Toronto. And in a sense, a city is a bit like a hive, isn't it?
Totally. Like, totally. And, you know, it's really interesting. One of the things that I've started to look at, and actually much of it was through Mafonwy's research, is how much is written about the analogies joining architecture and hives, and, you know, structurally from a kind of planimetric perspective. In many ways, you can use metaphors from both to talk about the, you know, the issues of community, of organization. It's interesting.
Getting to the final design was not easy, Jana told me. Both she and Mafanui had different visions of what the installation should look like. But things came together while the two of them went on a research trip to, of all places, Tokyo.
We settled on Japan for two reasons. In Tokyo, one of the oldest rooftop apiary organization was going strong in Tokyo. And so we felt that that would be a great thing to go and research, because in urban conditions, rooftop apiaries are becoming a really important part of creating a biodiverse landscape. Also in Japan was an architect named Fujimori, who's very well known for his very idiosyncratic work, especially in recovering old Japanese techniques. So his charred cedar house is a really well-known example of a technique, charring wood to make it waterproof, that hadn't been used in a long time. And so we went there, and as we were going, we were talking about different ideas, and we had a very, very different idea about what we would do. But when we were in Japan, we realized that beekeeping in cities and beekeeping as a kind of activity was very community-based and community-oriented, and in some ways amplified the idea about a beehive, which is really a community of bees, you know, working together to do something.
It is this spirit of community, of common purpose, that is at the core of the installation. Jenna says the one thing she wants visitors to take away is an interest in other forms of nature and their relationship to us. In a way, I guess that makes sense. After all, aren't we all bees in the same hive? For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Jason Lee.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. And to play you out, from the Bees of Toronto, we're going to head to the Isle of Wight with the local band The Bees and their song Listening Man. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.